They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Federalist Society's Student Division recently concluded its Federalist Papers Book Club, which ran weekly on Tuesday evenings for 10 one-hour sessions. In this session, Dr. John S. Baker, Jr. discusses Federalist Numbers 47, 48, and 51, which discuss the Constitution's separation of powers. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome, everyone. This is the sixth session of our book club. Tonight, we're going to be talking about separation of powers and finishing up in Federalist 51, a wrap-up of what we've gone through before. I'm dealing with some sinus congestion, so if it happens that I go into a coughing or a sneezing fit, our director, Brom, will give a full screen to whatever questions up at the point, and he'll mute me while I deal with that, and I'll be back very shortly. Hopefully it won't happen, but it may happen. Okay, because we have so much this evening, we don't have any student questions, but I do have one question from a live audience participant that was actually very helpful in one point in terms of what we want to do tonight. So this is from Jeffrey. He talks about my bringing up the Calvinist and the influence and the Mayflower Compact. So he asked about whether there are any particular books. And I give him several books from my former colleague at LSU, a political scientist named Ellis Sandoz. We've sent Jeffrey the list. If you would like the list and don't have time to copy it down, email us, and my student, young lawyer's assistant, will email you back as he deals with generally anything on the comment line. The other point that is made is this point down here. Can it be found with comparable or greater validity in any other representative democracies in history? You know, he mentions the Roman Republic. The Roman Republic certainly had its own gods, and that was an important element as far as Cicero was concerned. Later, there was the Holy Roman Empire, which was initially completely Catholic. And then after the Martin Luther King posted his thesis, we got into religious wars in Europe. Why is this important for tonight? Because the religious wars are ended basically by the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. And that gave to the different countries complete sovereignty. That's the beginning, really, of what we know as the nation state. But it also gave to the prince in each of those countries the absolute power to determine the religion of his subjects. Now, that affects Madison a great deal. People mostly know about Madison in Virginia and his fight along with Jefferson for religious freedom. But Madison, we'll see again, in dealing with the nation as a whole, is talking about multiplicity of sects and competition among them. So we go off right away to Federalist 47. And the first slide here, the objection to the Constitution, it violates the principle of separation of powers. One of the principal objections inculcated by the more respectable adversaries in the Constitution, this is how he gets certain digs in. He recognizes different levels of argument. Is its supposed violation of the political maxim that the legislative, executive, and judiciary departments ought to be separate and distinct. In the structure of the federal government, they claim there's no regard for that. So that's what he's got to address, because at the end here, he says, well, you know, if that were true, if it violated separation of powers, then, of course, we couldn't defend it. The reality is the most important part of the Constitution certainly as far as Justice Scalia was concerned, is separation of powers. So over 29 years, I had the privilege of teaching with Justice Scalia roughly every 2 years. And in all of those sessions, except the first, the course was on separation of powers. So let's go to the next slide. Improper mixtures of powers would be tyranny. That's what the opponents say. The accumulation of all powers in the same hands, whether of one, a few, and the many, whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elected, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. Where does this come from? Next slide. Once again, we see Montesquieu. Now, think about it. Montesquieu was the oracle, the great oracle, the celebrated oracle, he calls him, on federalism. And both the anti-federalists claimed him, and the federalists at least used him against the anti-federalists in arguing the point about a confederal republic. But Montesquieu used the British Constitution as his model. He says what Homer has been to the didactic writers of epic poetry. Here's the problem. Britain has never had separation of powers. What they have is separation of function, and that's different. And yet, apparently, he didn't fully understand it because he's basically the one that is articulating. He's not the first one. John Locke actually talked about a form of separation of powers, but it's different. On the slightest view of the British Constitution, we must perceive that the legislative, executive, and judiciary departments are by no means totally separate and distinct from each other. Now, when we go later, what we're going to see is there is another issue regarding the British Constitution and a resulting confusion in this country on not understanding enough about the British Constitution to realize how different we are. Next. Okay, Montesquieu allowed each department to have a partial agency. He did not mean that the departments ought to have no partial agency in or no control of the acts of the others. His meaning, as his own words import, and still more conclusively, as illustrated by the example in his eye, England, can amount to no more than this, that where the whole power of one department is exercised by the same hands, which possess the whole power of another department, the fundamental principles of free constitution are subverted. Next slide. No state keeps departments completely separate. What Madison is pointing to is that you look around the different states, none of them do it. None of them. If we look around, there's not a single instance. New Hampshire, whose constitution was the last form, seems to have been most fully aware of the impossibility and inexpediency of avoiding any mixtures, whatever these departments, as separate and independent of such each other, as the nature of free government will admit. That's the problem. Next slide. This Constitution is consistent with Montesquieu and the Massachusetts Constitution. What's interesting about that is Justice Scalia in our seminars would always quote this from the Massachusetts Constitution, that the legislative department shall never exercise the executive and the judicial powers, or either of them, the executive shall never exercise the legislative and judicial powers, or either of them, the judicial shall never exercise the legislative and executive powers of either. But no, in our Constitution, the term separation of powers doesn't appear. Now, for a textualist originalist, that might seem to be a problem. But as Justice Scalia always pointed out, the first few words of each of the three articles designates that department has the power named legislative, executive, and judicial. Well, why didn't they just say separation of powers? Well, for one thing, it meant different things. It meant different things, both in theory and in practice. And the point was that in practice, it wasn't working out well according to the theory. So what's going to happen is that the new model of separation of powers is both a mix of some of Montesquieu's insights, but a tweaking based on the experiences that they've observed in the states. This declaration corresponds precisely with the doctrine of Montesquieu as it has been explained, and is not in a single point violated by the plan of the convention. It goes no further than to prohibit any one of the entire departments from exercising the powers of any other department. But this is not far enough. The reality is that Montesquieu was writing a theory. He wasn't actually forming a government. And the devil is in the details, as they found out. And the theory by itself was insufficient. Next slide. We're going to Federalist 48, and I have a different type of slide coming up. So is the solution to be found in, quote, checks and balances? Checks and balances does not appear in the Constitution, except it's in the Constitution at all. And it doesn't appear in the Federalist Papers, except in Federalist 9. And when we went over that, it was among the new inventions or discoveries that Hamilton is talking about. And what he says are legislative checks and balances. Why? Listen to this from the famed great constitutional historian Forrest MacDonald. Many American patriots became disillusioned with the idea of checks and balances by reading a single grand polemical tract, Thomas Paine's Common Sense. After Paine's onslaught, Americans tended by and large to embrace the doctrine of separation of powers rather than the idea of checks and balances. Why? Checks and balances, which had characterized European governments based on Aristotelian principles, also were grounded in England in class. What do I mean? There is the monarch. It's an hereditary monarchy. It was an hereditary aristocracy, the House of Lords. The House of Commons, remember, the commons were not citizens. They were subjects of the king. They had a voice, but the whole idea was the three different institutions, the king, the one, the lords, the few, and the commons, the many, would contradict or conflict with each other and balance each other because they represented different viewpoints and different statuses in society and different economic situations. The whole point about the United States is there is no more hereditary monarchy. There is no more hereditary aristocracy. So we're dealing with some of the same concepts, but we do a complete new arrangement based on separation of powers rather than checks and balances. But what about gridlock? If you watch the 7-minute piece by Justice Scalia when he was at the Senate hearing back in 2011, you know, he cheers gridlock. The one thing he doesn't do sometimes is to distinguish two types of gridlock. Separation of powers, we're going to see, deliberately structures a slowing down of the process, not to stop it, but to force a consensus where not just a simple majority, but an overwhelming consensus is satisfied with the legislation. That's how we've had political peace largely in this country until relatively recently, when we've largely abandoned these kinds of notions. There is a separate gridlock that is produced in the administrative state where unelected officials end up not just writing rules that do Congress's job, but, quote, calling for comments as if somehow those comments matter. Sometimes they do in industry cases, but on more sensitive matters, the ideologues, whoever they are in the administration, have decided what the result is going to be. They've moved self-government into the agencies with a fig leaf of self-government. It's not self-government at all. Next slide. Okay, so we're going into 48. Separation of powers in practice requires some blending of powers. Okay, he's already established that you don't have to have a pure form. Some blending is necessary. I shall undertake in the rest, next place, to show that unless these departments be so far connected and blended as to give to each a constitutional control of the others, the degree of separation which the maxim requires as essential to a free government can never be in practice duly maintained. Look, they were looking at what was happening with states. And basically, as Justice Scalia says in one of his opinions on an act by Congress to overturn a judgment by the Supreme Court itself, that look, in the states, they were running roughshod. The legislatures were over both the judiciary and the executive in that state. Next slide. But if you don't know this history, you lack the context to understand why a result should be one way or the other, given the text. The text by itself, without context, can be very misleading. The practical difficulty preventing one department from invading the others. Well, we see that all the time in this country. Everybody seems to be doing their own, not their job, but somebody else's job. It is agreed on all sides that the powers properly belonging to one of the departments ought not to be directly and completely administered by either of the other departments. Justice Scalia's famous dissent in Morrison v. Olson is all about this. It is equally evident that neither of them ought to possess directly or indirectly an overruling influence over the others in the administration of their respective power. Guess what? In Justice Scalia's separation of powers course, that's what it was all about. That is a history often of how the legislature, the Congress, has created all these executive agencies under their control in reality. Why? It's all about the money. It's all about the money. More about that later. After discriminating, therefore, in theory, the several classes of powers as they can in their nature be legislative, executive, or judiciary, the next and the most difficult task is to provide some practical security for each against the invasion of the others. What the security ought to be is the great problem to be solved. We solved it. Madison, I mean, he was the theorist, political theorist, much more than Hamilton was. Next slide. Parchment barriers do not work. Another way of saying it, as Justice Scalia is, a Bill of Rights without separation of powers is worthless, absolutely worthless. He would always say every tin horn dictator in the world, the first thing he does is to proclaim a Bill of Rights. And then he would go through the beautiful Bill of Rights written out by the USSR or Iran, much better on paper than that of the US. Will it be sufficient? No, it's not sufficient. This is the security which appears to have been principally relied on by the compilers of most of the state American Constitution. Guess what? It still is. So if you look at some of our state constitutions, they're frankly no better than third world constitutions. They really aren't. I mean, some of them run 150 pages, just like these banana republics. And don't be surprised that they, you know, act like banana republics. Now, how can I, a Federalist who, you know, often champions the states against the federal government, say such a thing? It's all about the balance of powers. And the Constitutional Convention was about making the central government more effective in a limited area. It wasn't about expanding all of its powers. What you have at the state, and they understood it, they had to put limitations on the state. I often say that after working in a state legislature, as I have on occasion, it makes it very difficult sometimes to defend federalism when you see the idiocy that often goes on. But look, we've got 50 different jurisdictions, and they can compete with each other to be either better or worse. And that's turning out in COVID to be proven very well on the different pathways that are taken, not the legislatures, but by the governors. But experience assures us that these are greatly overrated. Down at the bottom, the legislative department is everywhere, extending the sphere of its activity and drawing all power into its impetuous vortex. That was the favorite phrase of Justice Scalia in the whole of the Federalists. He would say it in a really deep, intoned voice, full of mockery. Well, wait a minute. I thought he was always for deferring to the legislature, where it should be. Well, yes, that's the whole point. The judiciary should defer to the legislature. They can do what they can do as long as it's constitutional. Next slide. The danger from the legislative branch. Madison's being very, very delicate and polite here. No task can be less pleasing than that of pointing out the errors, what, of the states. Now, in reality, it was a great experimentation period. Without that experimentation period and all the errors of the states, we would never have had our Constitution, because they learned so much from it. The danger of liberty from the overgrown and all-grasping prerogative of an hereditary magistracy supported and afforded by an hereditary branch of the legislative authority. That's what the anti-federalists were focused on. What does he say? They seem never to have realized or recollected the danger from legislative usurpations, which by assembling all power in the same hands must lead to the same tyranny as is threatened by executive usurpations. Next slide. What you have to realize, and they never did in Latin America, is that the type of government you create will have different threats to it. And what he's going to say is that in a legislative department, in a republic like ours, the legislator is the greatest danger. Now, that goes against what a lot of conservatives believe. You can believe that things should be handled by the legislature, but as Madison's going to say, you better keep a close watch on them. You can't trust them. But in Latin America, they thought they were copying our Constitution. They didn't. They always say they did, but they didn't. They didn't understand. But their history and their tendency to put all power in the executive, that has held the day in many countries. So, and not only in Chavez's Venezuela, but in Ecuador, those places have simply dismissed members of the Supreme Court, just thrown them out of office as if it was, you know, a political thing that they could do. In a democracy where a multitude of people exercise in person the legislative functions and are continually exposed by their incapacity for regular deliberation and concerted measures to the ambitious intrigues of their executive magistrates, tyranny may well be apprehended on some favorable emergency to start up in the same quarter. There's always that temptation. Wherever you have enough power, you're going to try to get more. Next one. The legislature is the great danger in a Republican government. But in a representative republic where the executive magistracy is carefully limited. Okay, now, when Bush II was in presidency, it was constant. They were saying, he wants to be a king, he wants to be a king, he wants to be a king. That's always the argument that the anti-federalists have made from the beginning. And conservatives think, well, the president is too powerful. It is, again, not the president, it's the executive agencies, and they are the independent agencies are under the sway of the Congress. But even the ones that are not independent agencies are under the influence of money. The legislative power is exercised by an assembly, which is inspired by supposed influence over the people with an intrepid confidence in its own strength, which is sufficiently numerous to feel all the passions which actuate a multitude, yet not so numerous as to be incapable of pursuing the objects of the passions by means which reason prescribes. It is against the enterprising ambition of this department that the people ought to indulge all their jealousy and exhaust all precautions. And when we take up the house next time, you're going to see we have it. Next one. The reasons the legislator is the most powerful in a Republican government. The legislative power derives its superiority, its constitutional powers being at once more extensive, and this is important, less susceptible of precise limits. That's key. It can, with greater facility, mask under complicated and indirect measures the encroachment which it makes on the coordinate departments. This was what Justice Scalia was talking about in his course all the time. But think about this. Remember when John Kerry said, and others would have said the same thing, I voted for it before I voted against it. In the Obamacare bill, a bunch of Democrats voted for the key procedural maneuver, but then voted substantively against the bill at a point where that vote meant nothing. In other words, members of Congress in both parties are quite adept at playing the public for fools. And that's what goes on. It is not infrequently a question of real nicety in legislative bodies whether the operation of a particular measure will not extend beyond its legislative sphere. I had the experience about a year, maybe it's 2 years ago, when a staff member in the House called me on something and was asking me to interpret or tell them about a certain rule they had. And I said, well, in this rule, it says you have to do X. Oh, he said, well, we don't do that. I mean, we never really read the rule. Okay. I mean, that you can't make this stuff up. Anybody who's worked around there knows this. On the other side, the executive power being restrained within a narrower compass and being more simple in its nature, and the judiciary being described by landmarks, still less uncertain, projects of usurpation by either of these would immediately betray and defeat themselves. Now, you're going to say, well, wait a minute, how's the judiciary getting away with everything? Talk about this when we get to the judiciary. Too many members of Congress like it just well. They like it that way. It allows them to draft very broad, ambiguous statutes without having to offend anybody, kick it over to the courts, and then when a result comes out that some of their constituents do not like, say, well, you know, it's the court's fault. No, it's not the court's fault. It's your fault. You didn't draft the statute properly. You deliberately didn't do it that way. Next. Of course, if they drafted statutes properly, it takes a long time. The power of the purse, and this is the key one I've already mentioned, a prevailing influence or the pecuniary rewards of those who fill the other departments. A dependence is thus created in the latter, which gives still greater facility to the encroachments of the former. During the Reagan administration, it came out after a while that in one part of the Justice Department, 300 people who had been fired had been hired back. And when the acting head of that department was asked why he did that, he said, well, you know, we thought you just wanted to have a show of the numbers being reduced. So we hired him back as temporaries because after all, we had the money and we knew that Congress wanted us to spend the money. And then the reality is everybody spends whatever money they have before the end of the budget year. Otherwise it has to go back to Congress. Why do we let them do that? You wonder how the monies keep going up and up that we need? Next slide. Experience of the states shows parchment barriers are not sufficient. Virginia made this great statement about separating, but as Madison said, but no barrier was provided between these several departments. Next slide. This is from Jefferson. As you know, Jefferson and Madison were close. As I said, although Jefferson opposes Hamilton in the Washington administration, he nevertheless endorsed the Constitution and he endorsed the Federalist Papers. So here's what he's saying. He endorsing separation of powers. Of course, he did all this before Marbury versus Madison, and Marbury is all about, we'll talk later, about separation of powers. It's not about judicial review. That's Jefferson didn't disagree with judicial review. He disagreed with the view of judicial review elaborated in Federalist 78. The concentrating these in the same hands is precisely the definition of despotic government. Now he goes down, and elective despotism was not the government we fought for. Guess what? Elective despotisms have been promoted by our State Department for a long period of time. Why? Years ago, I lectured in Argentina to the Foreign Service School there, and I was lecturing on all this, and a hand goes up and says, but you're telling us something different from what the State Department tells us. They tell us that we need to have a parliamentary system. Well, for years, the State Department has been dominated by progressive thought, and they really do not like our Constitution. So what they're promoting to the rest of the world is not what we have ourselves. And you wonder why we have problems in these countries. Many of those problems we've made through our government, our own problems. Next slide. He gives the example of Pennsylvania. Get this one. In Pennsylvania, a great number of laws had been passed violating, without any apparent necessity, the rule requiring that all bills of a public nature shall be previously printed for consideration of the people. Now, what does this Congress do and the last Congress do? First of all, for many Congresses, as we've mentioned before, they draft 1,000, 2,000 page bills. They give you 3 days to read it. That is, if you're in the Congress. Well, when does the public get to read this? Where is the notion that the public ought to be able to read the bills? Well, if they actually had to write shorter bills and competent bills, and they couldn't kick it over to the executive agencies, there would be time for those bills to be public. But who now knows about the bills? Those who have the money as a group to have lobbying in Washington, they know about the bills. They work on the bills ahead of time. That's why many of the American people feel that they lack self-government. They do. It is a lack of self-government. The way we are operating now is in such violation of what the Constitution created that it's hard to imagine. Next. The conclusion is that parchment barriers are not sufficient protection. The mere demarcation on parchment doesn't do anything. That's what he's saying. That is why later the Federalist opposes a Bill of Rights. And yet, when you ask most Americans, what's the most important part of the Constitution? They will say the Bill of Rights, because they've never been taught that the structure of the Constitution is the primary protection of rights. As Justice Scalia would say, the Bill of Rights is the icing on the cake. But without the cake, you don't have much to eat. Next slide. Okay. Going into Federalist 51, this is the wrap up, but there's going to be a tie-in to separation of powers and human nature that's very important. And then he'll remind us about Federalist 10. So he's putting separation of powers and Federalist 10, federalism, all as part of one federal system. In the U.S., when you refer to federalism, as I mentioned earlier, it's not just about vertical federalism. It is the whole system together of how the federalism and the separation of powers elements work together as a new form of compound federal republic. First slide. Internal rather than external restraints. This is going to relate to what I said at the beginning in regard to Jeffrey's question. To what expedition shall we finally resort for maintaining in practice the necessary partition of power among the several departments. The only answer that can be given is that as all these exterior provisions are found to be inadequate, the defect must be supplied by so contriving the interior structure of government as it is several departments may, by their mutual relations, be the means of keeping each other in their proper places. I've used the analogy of an engine. An engine is self-contained. He's talking about that kind of a structure. I'm going to go on regarding Jeffrey's question to talk again about the question of external influences. Next slide. Each department must have a will of its own. Now, this may seem unseemly to some people, but it has to do with human nature. It is evident that each department should have a will of its own, and consequently should be so constituted that the members of each should have as little agency as possible in the appointment of the members of the others. With this principle rigorously adhered to, it would mean that it should all be drawn from the people. But that's not going to work in a republic. Next slide. There's some deviations, and in particular the judiciary. Why? Because of the peculiar qualifications for good judges, and also the permanent tenure must, and this is a great line that every president needs to read, must soon destroy all sense of dependence on the authority conferring them. Presidents often expect their Supreme Court appointees to be, quote, loyal to them. Well, so many presidents have found out the hard way. That's not how it works. And it's by design that they will not be loyal in a certain sense. It's not their job to be loyal. It's their job to construe the Constitution. Next slide. The executive and judiciary need financial independence from the Congress. That's key, absolutely key. We know about that. Most people know that judges' salaries cannot be reduced. A lot of people don't realize that the president's salary cannot be raised or reduced while he's in office. It has to be after the term that you change it or for the next president. Next slide. To resist other departments, each department needs means and motives, namely ambition. May seem unseemly, but the great security against a gradual concentration of the self powers in the same department, which I think has been going on for a long time, consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist the encroachments of the others. And this is a very famous phrase quoted by a lot of people in Europe after the fall of the Soviet Union. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. When we get to the judiciary and talk about Marbury versus Madison, that's a big part of what's going on. Next slide. And this is probably the most quoted statement from the Federalist. It may be a reflection on human nature, and that's why, in part, it's most quoted. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. Again, after the fall of the Soviet Union, people in Eastern Europe were reading the Federalist. And that's the one line in particular that you would see bandied about. Next one. Conflict and competition among departments, a policy based on prudence. The policy is supplying by opposite and rival interests the defect of better motives. You know, a lot of people think that members of Congress and members of agencies should have high motives. It would be nice, but unfortunately, too many people in Washington, whether in the legislative or executive branch, are there to pad their resume, especially in executive agencies, but even in Congress. For some in Congress, that job is simply a nice stepping stone to a much higher paying lobbying job. I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing. I'm talking about people who may be going there for that very purpose. That the private interest of every individual may be a sentinel over the public rights. These inventions of prudence cannot be less requisite in the distribution of the supreme powers of the state. It's such a realistic understanding of human nature, and fitting the powers of government as closely as you possibly can to anticipate the way people think and act, often generally in their self-interest. Next slide. Republican government, the legislative branch is the strongest, therefore divided. We've already established it's the strongest. And that's why he says you can't give to each department an equal power of defense. The Congress needs no defense powers. It's got more powers than it needs. In fact, it doesn't use much of its power, namely its power to legislate. In Republican government, the legislative authority necessarily dominates. The remedy is to divide the legislature into different branches. Often, the media will say when somebody is elected president and the same party controls both houses, they say, well, now there's a mandate and there won't be gridlock. That's nonsense. I mean, the whole point is, even in the same party, when they control it, there are differences. They don't necessarily get along. The House and the Senate don't necessarily get along under the same party leadership. By different modes of election, that's key, and different principles of action, as little connected with each other as the nature of their common functions and their common dependence on society will admit. They want it to be difficult to get legislation through the Congress. That's why you have two houses and why they operate very differently. I mean, we know that the Senate is considered elite, supposedly the most exclusive club in the world. I think it's not quite living up to some of its past history, but certainly at one point it was. Think about the fact that in the 1830s, another Frenchman, Tocqueville, coming to the United States, observed that while those in the House were rather mediocre, those in the Senate were statesmen of equal rank of the best in Europe. That's an amazing statement after only 50 years under a constitutional government. By different modes of election, etc., this was completely thought out. The whole idea that the Constitution is a hodgepodge because there were some compromises is complete nonsense that Americans have been taught, which is simply a way of undermining their respect for the Constitution. Next slide. The advantages of qualified veto. There was a debate in the Constitutional Convention about whether the president should have a complete veto or not. He didn't get a complete veto. And the advantages are going to be explained by Madison here. And it's whether they thought about it ahead of time exactly. You have to go back and reread the notes, Madison's notes. But it's clear that it worked out better than an absolute veto. As it was, the anti-federalists were arguing that the veto made the president part of the legislative process. And the defense to that is, well, yes, the president needs a weapon against the Congress, and the veto is it. But people know that the veto game is a game of chicken in a certain sense. That is, the president can threaten a veto, but whether the threat is taken seriously depends on, one, how hard members of the Congress really want to fight, and two, whether they have the votes. But notice this down at the bottom. May not the defect of an absolute negative be supplied by some qualified connection between the weaker department. Who's the weaker department? That's the president. And the weaker branch of the stronger department. What's that? That's the Senate, by which the latter may be led to support the constitutional rights of the former. The Senate may be led to support the president without being too much detached from the rights of its own department. In one way that the Senate was looked at by some, maybe more than some, was that it's really a bridge. That is, on the one hand, it's part of the Congress. On the other hand, it's allied on the president. So on appointments and confirmations, that's just the Senate. The House is out of it. On treaties, again, the president and the Senate, not the House. All of that was part of the design. Next slide. Now, here's where he's bringing the whole thing together. And the way you need to think about this is the redundancy. You know, if you're flying an airplane, and one engine goes out, it's supposed to be able to fly in the other engine or engines. It's called redundancy. In the Super Bowl games, they have more than one satellite uplink. In case one goes out, hopefully, except the way it happened in New Orleans a few years ago, it doesn't go dark. So two considerations of the federal system, why it is so really brilliantly drawn. First, in the single republic, what happens? All powers in one. At best, what you can do is have separation of powers. If you have a well-calculated separation of powers, you have some degree of freedom. But in the compound republic of America, the power surrendered by the people is first divided between the two distinct governments, and then the portion allotted to each subdivided among distinct and separate governments. Hence, you have a double security. That is, redundancy, arises to the rights of the people. The different governments will control each other at the same time that each will can be controlled by itself. Although in our first time teaching together, Justice Scalia and I agreed on the fact of the damage that the 17th Amendment did to federalism, the reality is today, the real protection for liberty has to come from separation of powers. How much can still be done by federalism is up to the majority of the Supreme Court. But as he used to say, don't count on us to save federalism. The American people don't care to save it. Next slide. Guarding society not only against government, but also against a majority. Now, this is back to Federalist 10. This is the second part. It is of great importance. Second part in 51, but it is of great importance in a republic not only to guard the society against the oppression of its rulers, but to guard one part of society against the injustice of the other part. If a majority be united by a common interest, the rights of the minority will be insecure. There are but two methods of providing against this evil. The one by creating a will in the community independent of the majority, that is, of society itself. Okay. This goes back to the opening and Jeffrey's comment and my answer. Dealing with the religious wars of Europe as a history, what they're concerned about is either they don't, certainly because they're all Protestant at this point or deist, they certainly wouldn't want the papacy, an external force, telling them what to do. But nor do they want any other external force telling them what to do. Well, what external force do we have today telling us what to do? Something that nobody could have anticipated back then because it's a technological issue. What high tech can do and is doing through social media makes a huge difference, and it allows very strong powers to be self-appointed and directing the society. This is extremely dangerous. Extremely dangerous. One of the things you have to understand is that politics in a way follows, quote, physics, or at least thinks it does. I'll leave it to the physicist to explain or how it does or doesn't. In any event, they thought they were following a Newtonian idea of physics. We have gone beyond that in many respects. Now, that's different from the progressive notion. Progressive notion is all about an evolving human nature. Nobody denies that technology is going to change over time. That's fine. We have to deal with it. Our Constitution has been able to deal with most of it, but the new power of technology is a great challenge to our constitutional structure. Next slide. The choice and authority independent of society or pluralism. So I've just gone I've underlined self-appointed authority. Who appointed the social media companies to decide who can be heard and who can't be heard? When our whole structure of government depends on everyone who wants to be heard, being heard. And controlling information is so inconsistent with the Constitution. They thought they had gotten away from that, and we had been away from it for over two centuries. And that is the second method will be exemplified in the Federal Republic of the United States, which is the pluralism of sects and opinions and parties and factions. Next slide. Security for civil and religious rights must be the same. Notice, again, as in 10, he's putting those two things together. What? The history of religious wars in Europe. The degree of security in both cases will depend on the number of interests and sects, and this may be presumed to depend on the extent of country and the number of comprehended under the same government. The whole idea that a certain set of opinions are acceptable and another set of opinions are not acceptable undermines this whole notion. Next slide. Justice through a properly formed federal system. A lot of people think, you know, this was just a bunch of white males getting together to create a constitution for their own benefit. That's complete nonsense. If they were going to do that, they wouldn't have had a federal system. You could say, well, they couldn't get it passed. But there were other things that they could have done. But the fact was, it was a convention instead, as in some countries, the legislature doing it in its own self-interest. The view of the subject must particularly be recommended a proper federal system. And it goes through all of what we've already talked about. Justice is the end of government. It is the end of civil society. Ever has been and ever will be pursued until it's obtained or until liberty be lost in the pursuit. As Reagan used to say, freedom is only one generation from being lost. Each generation has to renew that. And it's ultimately the education system where we're failing and seeing, apparently, a young generation that thinks that there's nothing wrong with socialism, which was described Federalist 10 as, quote, wicked, and certainly inconsistent with the Constitution. Next slide. Protecting all factions. It's not going to be just unless it does, but what are legitimate factions? The society and the forms which the stronger faction can readily unite and oppress the weaker. Anarchy may as truly be said to reign, as in a state of nature, where the weaker individual is not secured against the violence of the stronger. And that's why under contract theory, state of nature contract theory, people simply go into, under Hobbes' view, what could be a very totalitarian regime simply to protect themselves. But so in the former state, will the most powerful factions or parties gradually induced by a like motive to wish for a government which will protect all parties the weaker as well as the more powerful. Again, a series of points that Madison is making, that this is about protecting your different viewpoints, your different groupings in one society. Next slide. The extended republic will cause coalitions to produce justice. We're going to be going through the Congress in the next two sessions. And the way it's set up is to make, as Madison said, it difficult to pass legislation. And he recognized that some good legislation would fail to pass, but that it was more important to block bad legislation. And the idea that Congress does nothing often, which it does, but is not necessarily the ideal. That is, if Congress passes a few good bills, one that members of Congress actually read and craft, then we'd be way ahead of the game. So much of what Congress does, it doesn't have the power to do in the first place. But courts for over 70 years have been unwilling, except in a few instances, to say that what Congress has done is unconstitutional. There must be less pretext also to provide for the security of the former by introducing into the government a will not dependent on the latter, or in other words, a will independent of society itself. Again, we'll see what happens regarding social media. Next slide. The larger public is more capable of self-government. This was counterintuitive at the time. They thought that self-government was only possible in the small republic, as we've said several times, that the larger the society, provided it lie within a practical sphere, the more capable it will be of self-government. And happily for the republican cause, the practicable sphere may be carried to a very large extent by judicious modification and mixture of the federal principle. Done fairly well over 200 plus years. Some argue that we're too big. Some argue that we should be broken up. But if we would simply get back to much of what the framers' viewpoint was, we could deal with it, deal with many of the problems in a much better way. But again, it would require the Congress do more work, but enact fewer laws. Next. Okay, so we've got about just a couple of minutes here. And at the beginning of Federalist 10, I gave a brief mention of the outline. And now that we're ending at 51 with the general part, we'll go to the specific part. I'll go through the outline just briefly. Again, let's go, next slide. So the purpose of government is to protect liberty. This is 1 in 51, we've gone over that. I'm not going to spend time on this slide. I showed it before and we've just gone through it. Next slide. Okay, this one we didn't go through before, but we've talked about federalism, Federalist 39 and the important parts of Federalist 23. A government must act directly on individuals, not in state governments. The limited number of powers given to the federal government are the means necessary without limit to achieve the principal purposes of the union. That doesn't mean there's no limit to its power. It's a limited number of powers, and those limited powers have unlimited power. It is a division of powers. Next slide. Structure of American constitutionalism, federal and state. So it's separation of powers, which we've just gone through, so we don't have to repeat all that. Next slide. Constitutional controls, factions, federalism, and separation of powers, and then ultimately the Bill of Rights. That's what makes up our structure. The federal government and state governments check each other, Federalist 51. Unfortunately, state governments don't check the federal government anymore. By making the states part of the federal government through the representation in the Senate, by enforcing the Constitution as supreme law of the land through the federal courts, which we'll get to 78, rather than through force, which was the other option, courts protect rights by adhering to the Constitution's text. No authority for courts to interpret according to the spirit. We'll see that in Federalist 81. Courts are to be controlled by Congress's power to impeach. Brown, what happened? I lost it. Okay. So, is there anything else down? Scroll down there. Okay, that should be the last slide. Okay. So, Brown, would you put up again the email for anyone who wants to submit questions or comments or get the list of books? Send it to my assistant, Simon, and he'll respond to you. Thank you very much. We look forward to starting on this specific part next week, first of all, with the House of Representatives. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.